Dr. Yanikowski, if you're listening, you weren't able to silence me. Okay. Let me welcome you to the real America, the America born out of genocide of the indigenous peoples, followed when they were all killed off by 2.5 centuries of slavery, followed by another century of Jim Crow. We are the nation of atomic genocide in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, responsible for creating the nuclear arms race and the war crime and racist mass murder in Vietnam. We are the nation that gave the world My Lai, war criminal presidents but never a prosecution. We were told for decades we were the leaders of the free world when African Americans and whites could not eat together. We are still the world's superpower in the denial of human rights and its chief violator of both international humanitarian law and the laws of war. I was in Washington, D.C. 2 days ago, and I have to say, what are we thinking when we build monuments to slave-owning racists such as Washington and Jefferson? What are we thinking, or are we thinking at all, to immortalize and revere those who held others in bondage? And this is the nation we pledge allegiance to? This is the country that demands our children stand and pledge their loyalty to a flag that represents racism, colonialism, constant war, and a growing gap between rich and poor? The share of wealth held by the top 1% of Americans has risen to 35% from 21% since 1979. I can't pledge allegiance to this, and I won't. I am a citizen of the world, and look beyond borders and militaries and checkpoints and wars on terrorism, wars on Islam, and even wars on language, where we don't even use the word poverty anymore, as 1 out of 7 Americans are on food stamps. It's all middle class, see? I was a student of Howard Zinn, the great progressive people's historian and one of the great revisionist scholars in American history. I am here tonight, inspired by him, who was fired from a tenured position in the beginning of his career. I am here to test academic freedom and demand it for faculty such as Professor Capehart, who are willing to cross the line. Now, if enough people cross the line, we can eliminate the line. And the forces of elite rule and capitalistic greed that are destroying this nation for everyone but themselves. I have nothing against Northeastern Illinois University. In fact, for several years, my dean was Larry Frank, the current provost here, when he was, when I'm somewhat moderate, I get hell, okay. when he was dean of arts and sciences at St. Xavier University. I had differences with him by the time he left in 2002, particularly with his introduction of age as a criterion during a departmental search, which I have written about on my blog. But this stuff is never personal. Yet, as the Spanish philosopher Miguel de Unamuno said, sometimes to be silent is to lie. The academy, the professoriate, higher education in general, must stop lying in order to remain the only relatively free component of American intellectual and social life that can challenge illegitimate authority and the lack of moral integrity of this nation in a world desperate for peace and justice. NEIU on its website proclaims that it is ranked, quote, the most ethnically diverse university in the Midwest by U.S. News and World Report. It states it is 49% Caucasian, 25% Hispanic, 12% African American, 10% Asian, and 4%, as usual, other. That is something to be proud of, but I don't see data on faculty ethnic diversity. And frankly, when universities claim to be diverse, it only tells part of the story. It is not an insignificant part of the story, but incomplete nevertheless. Does it also respect diversity in thought and action? Does it validate anti-war faculty who oppose imperialism, mass murder, and racism? I did, and was suspended and reprimanded in one of the most controversial academic freedom cases of this century by former St. Xavier President Richard Yanikowski, an Air Force veteran. I fired off an anti-war email response to an Air Force Academy cadet's polite request that I recruit students to attend a conference there. He was not a student of mine, nor associated in any manner with St. Xavier. I don't recruit for war, for violence, for the professionalization of killing that so debases and demeans our planet's demand for justice. I won't do it. I stand here tonight and I say I reiterate my commitment to the ethical and moral premise, if not the entire tone of the email, and my right to denounce war and adhere to my pacifist, nonviolent ethical code, even in the case of self-defense. I could have been more polite, but here is the email that aroused the military all over the world and the Wall Street Journal twice. John Wilson wrote a letter to the Wall Street Journal on my behalf, but the Wall Street Journal wrote two editorials that demanded my suspension and removal of the classroom in the fall of 2002, and St. Xavier readily complied. Quote, "You are a disgrace to this country, and I'm furious you would even think I would support you and your aggressive baby-killing tactics of collateral damage. Help you recruit, who, top guns to rain death and destruction upon one non-white peoples throughout the world? Are you serious, sir? Resign your commission and serve your country with honor." I admit, I can tell it's been 9 years. Yeah. No war, no Air Force cowards who bomb countries without AAA, anti-aircraft artillery, without possibilities of retaliation. You are worse than the snipers. You are imperialists who are turning the whole damn world against us. September 11th can be blamed in part for what you and your cohorts have done to the Palestinians, the Viet Cong, the Serbs, a retreating army at Basra. You are unworthy of my support. That's all I wrote. Almost got me. My suspension and violation of my academic freedom was the result of my challenging directly American power and its militaristic, murderous foreign policy. I stand by others who denounce war, such as Professor Capehart has done. I could have been more polite, but that was the fig leaf. The real deal was denouncing American imperialism and racism, and St. Xavier University knew that. But so many there, with a few exceptions, chose to remain silent and to lie. I must say, however, because words travel rapidly, that the current president, Christine Wiseman, and her predecessor, Judith Dwyer, have not censured me in any manner and have made no effort to restrict or limit my academic freedom. We should praise administrators when they deserve it. I would like to believe my case and my refusal to be cowed or intimidated and my work for academic freedom since then contributed to a somewhat more open and permissive environment for other faculty as well. And, yeah, I'm just going to keep going until you tell me to stop. Universities... Stop. Universities that always claim to be diverse need to be also challenged whether they respect pro-union faculty who are willing to strike, if necessary, for basic rights, including the right to organize collectively. St. Xavier was one of the last private universities in the country to unionize before the NLRB v. Yeshiva case in 1980. Mr. Wilson mentioned this case. The Supreme Court ruled in that union-busting decision that faculty at private universities are managers, not employers, and therefore don't have the right to organize. Well, tell that to faculty members on non-union campuses that have no rights, no shared governance, no effective recourse to challenging administration diktat. Tell that to Norman Finkelstein. Tell that to Namita Goswami. Tell that to Maureen Larrady at DePaul, who were denied tenure. I didn't feel like a manager when I was suspended in 2002. I didn't feel like a boss when I was reprimanded. I did not feel like an employer when I was subjected to Gestapo tactics of abuse and intimidation from a nation clamoring to silence me and calling me, as David Horowitz did in his book, I'm kind of glad he did, the professors, that I was one of the 101 most dangerous academics in America, one of the 101 most dangerous academics in the U.S. I would hurt a fly, you know? Okay. unless it was red, white, and blue. Okay, no. NEIU is a public university where faculty do have the right to organize. And yet, as tonight is testimony, even a unionized faculty is not guaranteed basic rights of academic freedom, free speech, shared governance, and the right to challenge arbitrary authority or illegitimate actions from the administration. Let's look at what academic freedom is or should be. Not much of it is left in this country because we do not have a national organization that has both the progressive politics of ideological independence and the direct action, aggressive public challenging of the oppressive nature of academia. We have FIRE, Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which I love, and they saved my job. But they tend to be less than entirely committed to progressive values and critical thinking. But I admire their modus operandi and direct action tactics. They're really good. AAUP is moderately liberal, but far removed from reality, and is basically a quasi-law firm that writes reports and little letters that rarely help more than a small percentage of faculty who need protection from the age of conformity and persecution. I was glad they've helped you in your case, and I admire AAUP for doing that. But we need an organization that combines both ideological progressivism with direct action tactics. We have none, none. And the situation is dire in academia, absolutely dire, as we move to a one-party classroom, a one-party campus, where the avant-garde, the radical, the daring is destroyed and persecuted in the so-called democracy. Let me get to the... I'm going to skip because I've got 3 or 4 minutes, and I want to get to specifically the legal aspects of this. So let us begin here. The courts are trying to silence us, or worse, are indifferent to ideological cleansing that is sweeping higher education in a manner not seen since the McCarthy witch hunts of the 1950s. About 1,000 high school and college teachers lost their jobs during the 50s. In Garcetti v. Ceballos, the shameless, if not illegitimate, Supreme Court that literally stole the 2000 presidential election from Democratic Vice President Al Gore has basically ruled that public officials cannot criticize their employers. They can only address matters of public concern, whatever that means in the police state of America. The 5-4 majority ruled that speaking as a citizen with First Amendment rights of free speech does not count when an employee is speaking in the course of carrying out his or her public duties. Even if one observes and denounces illegal actions, such as an improper search warrant, like Garcetti did, one can face retaliation and punishment for voicing an objection. This decision was egregiously used by the Capehart case judge to silence a professor despite the decision's non-mandatory application to university professors. Judge Blanche M. Manning unprofessionally and injudiciously imposed her subjective ideological bias against a United States citizen seeking relief. Not even a jury trial with her peers was allowed. Another de facto evisceration of the Constitution, which is silent concerning summary judgments that are really summary executions of the Constitution when applied in this manner. True, one can appeal a summary judgment decision, but the burden falls heavily on the complainant in this instance, who dared to cross the line and to denounce war, racism, and administrative retaliation. We cannot allow government employees who we pay to be silenced and learn to shut up, and we should deploy all available means of nonviolent direct action to insist that constitutional rights do not end at the employer's door. Justice David Souter's dissent in Garcetti warned that stripping public employees of their free speech rights might encompass public university professors who dare defy the canon or illegitimate authority. Let me just quote from his briefly from his statement, and I'll wrap this up. Quote, this is from Souter's minority dissent in Garcetti v. Ceballos. This ostensible domain beyond the pale of the First Amendment is spacious enough to include even the teaching of a public university professor. And I have to hope that today's majority does not mean to imperil First Amendment protection of academic freedom in public colleges and universities whose teachers necessarily speak and write pursuant to official duties. And yet Judge Manning said in the case of Professor Capehart, when the plaintiff is a government employee, her speech made pursuant to her professional responsibilities is not protected by the First Amendment. What should not be protected by the First Amendment are judges and administrators and faculty members,
that wish to destroy the First Amendment and our rights to be human. And thank you very much.